Today at Reader's Corner, Maria Popova, co-author with Oksana Shevel of the new book, Russia and Ukraine, Entangled Histories, Diverging States. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In February 2022, Russian missiles rained on Ukrainian cities and tanks rolled towards Kyiv to end Ukrainian independent statehood. What are the roots of this war, which has upended the international legal order and brought back the threat of nuclear escalation? How did these supposedly brotherly peoples become present-day enemies? In their new book, Russia and Ukraine, Entangled Histories, Diverging States, Maria Popova and her co-author, Oksana Shevel, explain how since 1991, Russia and Ukraine diverged politically, ending up on a collision course we're bearing witness to today. Maria Popova joins us today from Montreal, Canada. Always nice to hear from someone from Canada these days. She's an associate professor of political science at McGill University and scientific director of the Jean Monnet Center, Montreal. Her first book, Politicized Justice in Emerging Democracies, won the American Association for Ukrainian Studies Book Prize in 2013. She has also co-written an article with Oksana Shevel for the National Interest magazine, which is required reading for anyone trying to figure out how an end to Russia's war on Ukraine can deliver justice for Ukraine. Maria Popova, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Maria, I'm going to give you the opportunity to talk a lot about your book, but let's try to zero in on four things that I found so fascinating. First of all, Putin's always claiming that Ukraine is nothing more than a vassal of Russia. So let's start with the 9th century. You can just give us an idea of who was where then. Secondly, talk about how Ukraine's national identity has been strengthened by religious reasons, judicial reform, anti-corruption reform, how it's moved closer to Western democracies as opposed to Russian autocracy. Third, why and how is there a need for major updates in Europe's political and security architecture? And finally, something about that article I mentioned, I thought that was very well done and is some very serious warnings to Americans on how to approach these peace talks, if we can call them that, this early. But let's get back to the beginning. Putin is constantly talking about Ukraine, that is his vassal, and doesn't deserve the independent recognition that the West is giving it. Take us back to that 9th century. Who came first here, Ukraine or Russia?
This is a really important question because it is really goes to the crux of the conflict. And it goes to the crux of the conflict because Putin does not believe that Ukraine is a separate thing from Russia. It's even more than believing that Ukraine needs to be a vassal. It's that he believes that Ukrainians are these wayward Russians who think they're Ukrainians, but in fact, they're nothing but little Russians. And with a funny language that he doesn't recognize to be its own language. And he goes back to the 9th century and to Kievan Rus because he claims that that Kievan Rus was Russia, when in fact it was Kiev and it was a medieval principality. And at that time, there was no Russia. There was only Kievan Rus. And so he sort of takes the idea that it was called Rus and claims that it means that it was Russia. So they're competing interpretations of that really deep history there. The one interpretation was that this was a medieval principality that is in Ukraine and what today is Ukraine, and it was its own thing, not Russia. Not really today's Ukraine, but it was clearly in today's Ukraine. What Putin and, in fact, Russian historiography overall wants to say is that this 9th century principality was, in fact, Russia. And therefore, Ukraine is Russia and belongs to Russia and should always belong to Russia. So you can see that's that deep disagreement about history is what is to a large extent driving even today's invasion that we see. I mean, it's no wonder that Putin talked about the ninth century to Tucker Carlson when he gave him an interview, you know, bored him to death with all this talk about centuries past. But it's because it is really an obsession and a fixation of Putin, but unfortunately, largely Russian common perception.
Well, let's fast forward to recent history, 2014, Putin's Russia marches into Crimea and says it's now part of Russia. That's a very interesting moment in time here, given the fact that the language, the citizenship, they all play such a vital role in distinguishing Ukraine from Russia, and yet Putin just rolls right over it, right?
Absolutely. I mean, by 2014, Ukrainians have had an independent state from the collapse of the Soviet Union, an independent state for over 20 years, right? And by 2014, they're deeply committed to their independent state. Their identity as a Ukrainian nation separate from Russia, with its own history, with its own language, with its own form of government, has really solidified to a great degree. And it's basically overwhelming. The majority of Ukrainians are committed to this independent statement. And when Putin rolls into Crimea in this surreptitious way, for a while he was denying that these are Russian troops that are taking over Crimean political institutions. But when that happens, at that point, what we see is not that Ukraine is okay with that, but at that point, Ukraine doesn't have really the military capacity. I mean, he really took them by surprise. They were not prepared for such an invasion. They did not expect it to come. They did not prepare militarily. And they were, in fact, told by their Western partners, by the Obama administration, not to fight this because, you know, Russia is a big power and maybe they'll go further. And the Ukrainians sort of took that advice and did not fight for Crimea. But as a result, we have ended up with this perception that somehow Russia taking Crimea was this bloodless, nonviolent thing that the Crimeans wanted to be in Russia, and there's nothing right about this. It was an invasion, military invasion by Russia. People did protest, but Russia is a well-oiled dictatorship machine that suppressed these protests. They faked the results of the referendum. So that's why we had a smoother type of invasion, but it was nonetheless still very much a Russia in the beginning of Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
And that sends a bit of a clue to Putin that, well, if this is all they're going to say about it, I might want to move into Ukraine in 2022, which of course he does. Today, I'm speaking with Maria Popova, co-author of the new book, Russia and Ukraine, Entangled Histories, Diverging States. The book examines how the fall of the Soviet Union started an identity and regime divergence between Russia and Ukraine and set both countries on an inevitable collision course. I'm glad you brought up Obama because I think, as you say in your book, the West missed opportunities in that year of 2014 and beyond, if nothing else, to exact more serious penalties of one kind or another, sanctions. But that didn't happen. And it really does seem to be one of the reasons why Putin has such a strong hand today, because nobody was taking him seriously enough then.
Absolutely. There were some sanctions, but they were not very extensive. And they were quite, you know, maybe obviously the West was concerned about the fact that this invasion was a violation of international norms, redrawing an attempt by Russia to redraw borders through force. That, of course, was a concern. But you're right that the West did not, in fact, take steps to deter Russia from further invasion, to send a clear message that if they weren't going to help Ukraine fight for Crimea, at least the West, what they could have done was to brainstorm, how do we stop Russia from going further? And the huge mistake that we talk about in the book is that the faction in the West that believed that leaving Ukraine in a buffer zone would actually placate Russia and would prevent a further invasion by leaving Ukraine outside of Western institutions, even though at that point they're begging to be admitted into NATO and the EU, by leaving them out of these, out of NATO specifically, the idea somehow won in the West that that's a good idea. In fact, this was the worst idea possible because it left Ukraine as a sitting duck for further invasion without any ability to protect itself. Now, over the next years after 2014, Ukraine did invest in its own defense. So they did build up the military to a significant extent. And so they built up their preparation for the 22 full-scale invasion. But the West was not helping in any serious way with this preparation. The West was accommodating Russia, was sort of thinking that by not helping Ukraine too much, they would be preventing further Russian attack. But in fact, it turned out that this was completely the wrong strategy because it sent a clear message to Putin that he could invade and take additional territory beyond Crimea and the parts of Donbass that he started to control in 2014. And that's what we saw in 22.
In the meantime, Ukraine in this period is doing a very serious job of improving the civic machinery of a democratic government. And it's very impressive in your book that you run down two or three of these. Maybe we can talk about just a couple. Judicial reform, for example, and how the legal codes were rewritten with an eye toward Ukraine's legal integration into Europe. Again, this is the question I mentioned at the outset. This is how Ukraine is building its national identity around the West and not around Putin's autocracy.
Exactly. It's in 2014 that it's really a watershed moment for Ukraine. Why? Because it becomes clearer to a big majority of Ukrainians that if they want to save their independent statehood, their road to democracy and integration goes through Europe. And what they then really commit to, and at that point, the entire political spectrum within Ukraine, sort of the mainstream parties in Ukraine, at that point, all of them commit to this idea that they have to reform the state to make it a well-functioning and well-developed democracy with human rights, the rule of law, well-functioning institutions with good state capacity, if they want to protect themselves from Russia. The models of democratic Europe versus authoritarian Russia are so different and so clear. The contrast is so clear. And for Ukrainians who want their independent statehood, it becomes so clear that they need to move to Europe in order to protect themselves from Russia, that they do, in fact, manage to push through a lot of very difficult reforms successfully through the EU conditionality that's built into this association agreement with the EU that the Ukrainian government signs. They reform the police in order to reduce corruption within the police. They reform the courts. They build anti-corruption institutions that are going after corruption in the public service. They decentralize the government in the sense that they give more power to local municipalities, more control over their budgets, more transparency and accountability for the local municipal institutions. So all of these reforms roll out. And I think the resilience and the effectiveness with which the Ukrainian state has resisted effectively the Russian invasion in 22 are sort of the, you know, the proof is in the pudding, right? It's the proof that these reforms were successful, because indeed the state was capable to then organize and mount a very significant and very successful defense when Russia did launch the full-scale invasion in 22.
You know, one of the things I found so fascinating, and I did not understand this or know about this until I read your book, is that nearly one third of Ukrainians reported watching Russian TV at the time of the 2014 attack in eastern Ukraine. And of course, we all know what Russian TV is like. You're not going to get any objective sense of the news on any given day. But the fact is, there were also some Gallup polls in 2014. And even with one third of the people watching Russian TV, where they're basically watching propaganda, along comes these Gallup polls. Do you recount what those words were like? But they were highly in favor of a democratic Ukraine, if I'm not mistaken.
Of course. Yeah, that's the thing that I think a lot of people fail to understand, that the cultural affinity that's the result of centuries of Russian colonialism in Ukraine, the fact that all Ukrainians speak Russian, that a certain proportion of them could be ethnic Russians as a result of Russia dominating the area, right? The fact that Ukrainians speak Russian, consumed Russian news, want to even think of themselves as Russian, does not mean that they wanted to be invaded by Russia. And we've seen this over and over. And Putin doesn't understand this to this day. Yeah. But unfortunately, some people in the West don't understand it either. But Putin actually told Tucker Carlson that one of the absurd situations in this war is that you have Russian-speaking Ukrainians shooting at the Russian soldiers that are invading them. And to him, this is some sort of absurd travesty, and it means that brothers are shooting each other. But in fact, it illustrates that Ukrainians, even those who do speak Russian, want to have a Ukrainian democratic state and are committed and are willing to lay down their lives to defend their Ukrainian independence. It doesn't matter that they speak Russian. So it's really not in any way this conflict, this some sort of ethnic conflict. I think actually Vice President Vance tried to claim that this is some ethnic conflict between Russians and Ukrainians, but he could not be more wrong about this. And we document this in the book that, in fact, Russian speaking and ethnic Russian Ukrainians are just as opposed to the Russian invasion as Ukrainian-speaking Ukrainians. Mm-hmm. It's not an ethnic conflict, but it is a conflict between an aggressor state, which is Russia, and the independent Ukrainian state that is committed to being a European democracy.
And just to make sure that all Ukrainians, both Ukrainians and Russians within the state of Ukraine, are loyal to the blue and the yellow, there were decommunization laws. What were those?
So the decommunization laws were more about, not really about a division between Russian speakers and Ukrainian speakers. They were really about rejecting the legacy of the authoritarian communist regime, but also rejecting Nazism. So basically what these laws did was that they outlawed glorifying the communist regime, the Soviet regime, and the Nazi regime, both of them. And the idea was that both of these regimes, Stalinist USSR, and Nazi Germany, both of those killed millions of Ukrainians. So these laws sought to reduce glorification of the Soviet regime, which was coming from Russia's post-Soviet policy. So what these laws did was they triggered a lot of discussion within Ukraine about changing the names of streets so as not to glorify the Stalinist members and collaborators who, for example, perpetrated the Holodomor in Ukraine, in which millions died of state-enforced starvation. So that was an attempt to really retell Ukrainian history from the perspective of Ukrainians, as opposed to having the elements of Soviet-imposed interpretation of history that was a remnant of the Soviet period.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Maria Popova, co-author of the new book, Russia and Ukraine, Entangled Histories, Diverging States. You have an excellent analysis toward the end of your book about Europe's political and security architecture, as you call it. And what this is really about is how Western Europe views those countries in Eastern Europe who are on the very verge of Russia. I wonder if you could share with us what your thoughts are on how you deal with this.
Yeah, what we argue in the book is that Europe, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, had this idea that there could be a collaborative, cooperative relationship with Russia based on mutual interest in trade, specifically in energy, and that this would have a moderating effect on any Russian revanchist ideas about reestablishing domination over the eastern part of Europe. And it's important to remember here that the way in which Eastern Europe ended up being part of the so-called Soviet bloc during the Cold War was not by their own choice. They were simply occupied by the Red Army in World War II and on its way to Germany. The Red Army had occupied all of these countries, the Baltics, Poland, Czechoslovakia, down to Bulgaria and Romania. So all of these, and of course, Western Ukraine, all of these countries were forced into the Soviet bloc. So after the Soviet bloc collapsed, after the Soviet Union collapsed in the 90s, the Eastern Europeans who regained their sovereignty and their independence were immediately concerned about the potential of Russia returning to dominate them. But Western Europe thought, well, maybe the years of domination are over, Russia has changed, and in any case, trading and establishing collaborative relationships with Russia are going to keep peace in Europe. So Russia is a major part of the European security architecture. That was the idea. However, it became clear over time that this was a mistake because Russian revanchism did reappear anyway, despite the trade, despite the friendly relations, despite all the overtures and all the ideas about Europe from Lisbon to Vladivostok and whatnot. Despite all of this, Russia started reestablishing and re-imperializing it's the area which it used to dominate. And as it started re-imperializing, more and more countries in Eastern Europe sought to look for security from this Russian revanchism. And yes, the Eastern Europeans that entered NATO were the lucky ones because they are now protected. But Ukraine was not accepted into NATO. And as a result, that's why we're seeing this invasion of Ukraine, because it is not protected. Who else has been invaded by Russia? Georgia. Also not in NATO, because they did not have the protection of the European and Euro-Atlantic security architecture. So the argument that we make in our book is that in order for peace to return to Europe, there needs to be a security architecture that's going to contain Russian reimperialization efforts. There's no good way to force Russia to compromise. I think we're seeing right now with Russia's rejection of a simple 30-day ceasefire that they're really not willing to compromise here. They want to retake reconquer these territories. And the only way to stop this is not really negotiation, not really compromise and accommodation. It's figuring out how to contain. The same thing that had to be done during the Cold War to contain Russia from expanding beyond the Eastern European states that it dominated.
It seems as though one of your points is that the Western countries in Europe have to take Eastern Europe more seriously as equal partners. And I saw that Poland, both its president and prime minister, are now on record as saying nuclear weapons should be either brought into Poland by the US, or at least Poland should be covered by what they call the French nuclear umbrella.
So that's the result of Russia's aggression. Of course, Poland wants protection. And of course, given that Russia has used nuclear blackmail to prevent the US from helping Ukraine sufficiently. Now, the Trump administration is a different story altogether, but the Biden administration, who wanted to help Ukraine, nonetheless did not help Ukraine sufficiently because they were afraid of Russia's nuclear blackmail. And as a result, this sent a really clear message to Europe that they all need to develop their own nuclear umbrella because they don't want to be the next in being blackmailed through the nuclear argument by Russia and invaded by Russia while everybody else stands by and is afraid to help because of nuclear arguments. So unfortunately, nuclear proliferation is now back on the agenda because so many countries in Europe are feeling insecure. And I mean, the Trump administration is also contributing to that feeling of insecurity. There talk about the U.S. no longer being a guarantor of European security is really concerning. It basically means that Europe needs to step up and needs to make sure that they are capable of containing Russia on their own. And that's why these countries are talking about it. And I think, indeed, in the last 3 years, we have seen a lot of progress within Europe in terms of Europe uniting and sort of letting go of this idea that there is Western Europe and Eastern Europe. It's all right. Europe. And it's all Europe trying to find protection in unity from Russian aggression. So I think some of the some of the recommendations that we make in the book, which we were writing in sort of late 22, early 23, have already been taken on board by the Western Europeans. And that's why we're seeing these common initiatives within Europe that include both East and West trying to step up and really protect Ukraine for their own sakes as well.
Maria, we're almost out of time, but I'm going to squeeze in one last question here that I hope you can help us with. Well, Maria, you and Oksana Shevel wrote a column for The National Interest, the magazine. And in it, you suggest that we have to be very wary of a Russian peace agreement. Why?
So Ukraine is very clear-eyed about how Russia conducts negotiations. So they know that Russia will try to use the diplomatic process to establish control over Ukraine's central government, that they will try to come up with all these ideas for how for that allow interference by Russia in Ukraine's domestic affairs. And what we try to do in this piece is warn the American administration that negotiating a compromise with Russia will be extremely difficult, if not impossible, because basically the Ukrainian commitment to its independence and Russia's continuing commitment to dismantling the Ukrainian state make the two objectives irreconcilable. So that's why we tried to warn that a quick peace of some sort is really not possible, because Russia is unlikely to agree to a compromise. It's likely to try to use the negotiation process to impose demands on Ukraine that are virtually equivalent to capitulation, because that's what they've been trying to do these 3 years. And so we warn against the idea that bringing back all the proposals, for example, from the Istanbul negotiations that took place in the beginning of the full-scale invasion, then any of this is any compromise, when in fact it was Russia's demand for Ukrainian capitulation. And unfortunately, what we see today is that Russia has rejected the ceasefire and is indeed going down a long list of demands. And so a quick peace that the Trump administration envisioned is not on offer. And it remains to be seen how the Trump administration is going to respond to this. But they should be facing the reality that Russia is not offering either compromise or peace.
Remains to be seen is a good way of putting it. But in the meantime, to understand at all where we are today, it's the book Russia and Ukraine, Entangled Histories, Diverging States. The authors, Maria Popova, Oksana Shevel, and Maria Popova has been our guest today on Reader's Corner. Maria, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for the book.
Thank you so much for having me.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is James Baker, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
In Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.